You're listening to Between, Across, and Through. We always hear about the firsts, the first woman to fly a plane, the first Indigenous member of Parliament, the first Black president of the United States. They're supposed to be trailblazers. Supposedly, they open the doors to minorities just like them. But how often does this actually happen? How often do they change the system? And how many people actually get to follow? Today, Professor Kevin Lewis O'Neill, Director of the Center for Diaspora and Transnational Studies, speaks with Professor Rinaldo Walcott from the Department of Sociology and Equity Studies at the University of Toronto, in a conversation about the dangers of the language of multiculturalism, which makes it very difficult to be the first without being the last. Please join us as we travel between, across, and through.
Welcome. I'm Professor Kevin Lewis O'Neill, and I'm speaking with Professor Rinaldo Walcott. Thank you for joining us. Rinaldo, your research has an interesting title, The End of Diversity. Why'd you name it this?
Yeah, I call that particular essay The End of Diversity because I was trying to intervene into all of the ways in which I felt that notions and practices of diversity within institutions like universities, art galleries, museums, and in the general public discourse had produced this idea that the more non-white people sitting at tables meant that systematic and institutional change was happening. And I wanted to point out that that wasn't the case. But I also want to make the claim that in the post-Barack Obama era, that the kind of rhetoric around the kind of exceptional non-white person should be brought to an end as quickly as possible.
In the essay, the United States plays a very important role intellectually for you, or analytically for you. What is the role of the United States in this conversation about diversity?
So I think that one of the things that's really interesting is that even though Canada has an official multicultural policy and has, you know, since the 70s branded itself, and especially its major cities, as some of the most multicultural in the world and so on, that the rhetoric and the discourse and even the practice of some idea of multiculturalism often still takes its lead from what happens in the U.S., a place that doesn't have an official multicultural policy, and that, in fact, at the vernacular level, sees itself as a melting pot as opposed to being a multicultural nation. So that's why, for me, it's really difficult not to read what's happening in Canada through what's happening in the U.S. And of course, you know, we're all living in the era of the U.S. empire. So there's a way in which what happens at the imperial center impacts what happens in the peripheries and the margins. But secondly, because I write through the lens of Black studies and through the lens of Black diaspora studies, you know, I often find myself turning to the U.S. and trying to figure out what's happening with Black communities and populations there as a way of thinking about how to address what I see are similar questions, but often with different articulations happening in the Canadian nation space.
Is it fair to say that the U.S. is a global leader in the sense of, you know, whether it's a global leader in like white supremacist attitudes or a global leader in conversations about assimilation? Like, Canada's relationship to the U.S. is critical, I suppose, here.
It's definitely critical. I think the question of leader and leadership is an interesting one. How it works for me is that there's a set of contradictions. So there's a way in which, if I go back to this idea that the U.S. doesn't have an official multicultural policy, but Canada has one. But yet there's a way in which one can imagine forms of Black life in the U.S. that would never be possible in Canada. Mm-hmm. So we've already invoked Barack Obama. We can't still imagine a Black Prime Minister of Canada. Huh. But yet the U.S. has already had a Black president. And it's those contradictions that I'm often trying to think about and work with in my research. And some of those contradictions sit behind what I was trying to do with this essay as well.
And in your essay, you say that, quote, white people collectively lie to themselves, end quote, so they can believe life and social organization as it stands gives everyone equal opportunity. How is that kind of collective consciousness achieved?
Well, I mean, I think it's achieved in a bunch of ways. One is that, you know, there's just this general idea that the democratic nation state that we live in is necessarily an egalitarian nation state. And people who veer away from saying that it's an egalitarian nation state are often denounced in the strongest terms or simply dismissed and sidelined as irrelevant to the conversation. The conversation proceeds as though there's not opposition and protest to the idea that we live in an egalitarian society. And while I think that sometimes, you know, part of the contradiction with comparing, say, Canada and the U.S. is that there are spaces in the U.S. nation space where they're willing to admit that egalitarianism is an ideal, but it's not been reached.
Right.
And that opens up a different set of kinds of possibilities that I think are often shut down in the Canadian nation state.
And so in the Canadian nation state, I mean, so as someone from the United States, I can see how there could be pushback here in Canada against the idea that there are pockets where egalitarianism is an ideal but not yet achieved. And you feel like that's a strong sense here in Canada.
Yeah, like I feel that the rhetoric of Canada is one of egalitarianism, even though there's a lot of evidence to prove that it doesn't exist,
sure.
Whether we're thinking about Indigenous communities, whether we're thinking about Black communities in both urban and rural areas, you know, just generally speaking, that there's more possibility of beginning from a place of non-egalitarianism in the U.S. context, where
sure.
People immediately acknowledge that Indigenous people and Black people are the lowest rungs of the society, are excluded from all kinds of institutions, and then there will be the rhetoric of you can become something. While in Canada, the conversation is shut down immediately.
Interesting.
By saying, you know, this is who we are, and we are egalitarian society.
Right. I mean, Barack Obama's dominant narrative was this kind of self-conscious reflection on even, you know, me from Kansas and...
Exactly. He called it the improbable narrative.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. The improbable narrative. Absolutely. Yeah. How could this collective consciousness be disrupted?
Well, I think part of what I was trying to do in that essay is to disrupt it by revealing that whiteness is an operative structure in Canada and that the default in Canada is whiteness. It's a particular sense of something that we might call Europeanness, and that the languages of diversity and equity and inclusion, while necessary and while languages that came out of non-white people struggling to create a more egalitarian society, that those languages have now become a way to paper over the ongoing inequalities
sure.
of the society. Yeah.
I mean, your language of adjunct is interesting. In your paper, you reference the term junior partner. Can you say a little bit more about what you mean by junior partner?
So I borrowed the term junior partners from the African-American scholar and artist Frank Wilderson III. And what Frank Wilderson is trying to get at by using that term is to say that even in the absence of white people to enact the structure of white supremacy, that non-white people whom he termed junior partners can also act in that way. And so part of what I was suggesting by my own use of it is that often in like the offices of diversity and so on, that the people who occupy those offices, not necessarily consciously, but just given the way in which the structures work, become junior partners in maintaining the system as it is.
Mm. I mean, so Barack, I mean, is I don't know. I mean, I've never thought of this way. Is Barack Obama part of this kind of universe, or is it?
Yes, he would be a principal and,
right.
and symbolic, massively symbolic
one would,
figure
yeah.
of being a junior partner in terms of U.S. empire, right?
Right.
That U.S. empire can have a Black man, a man who symbolically represents some of the most oppressed people globally, whether we're talking about the African continent, North America, the Caribbean,
yeah.
wherever Black people live, be the face of empire, be the face of global terror, oppression, global capital, global inequality. So yeah, he embodies that junior partnership in some ways. But I want to get at it at a much more micro level, which is to say that, you know, when we make a case for entering institutions like universities, museums, art galleries, institutions that are not going to fundamentally change, but they've been able to accommodate some of us who were traditionally excluded, that we become a part of maintaining and reproducing something that harms large numbers of people from communities that we come from. And yet at the same time, we also become examples of those institutions appearing to be doing good work.
Right. I mean, your language, the difference between changing and accommodating seems really important.
Yes.
How do you begin to reject this narrative as a Black professor here at the University of Toronto? Mm-hmm.
The first thing that I do, and it took me a long time to get to this point, is to recognize that I myself too must live with a contradiction. And the contradiction is that, yes, in relationship to the ways in which our society structures a set of hierarchies, in relationship to a series of communities, whether the Black communities, queer communities, someone like myself finds themselves in a different relation.
Sure.
Because I don't want to say hierarchy, or I don't want to say privilege, because I don't think that those really capture it. But I find myself in a different relation to some of the communities that I come from. And so I have to live with that contradiction. But I also feel that what I try to do is to speak with those communities as well. So I don't speak for them. I'm not a representative of them, but I'm a member of those communities who's trying to bring the concerns and the interests and the desires and the hopes of those communities into these institutions, into an institution like University of Toronto, mm-hmm. and hopefully to disrupt it enough so that I'm not the only one and so that I'm not the last one.
Right.
Yeah.
And with the contradictions you speak about and the language of adjunct and junior partnership, all that is the conditions of which are set by the language and the ideology of diversity.
Yeah.
There's an idea out there that when someone from a marginalized or racialized group gets an important position, for example, becomes a professor or a CEO, it should be celebrated as an advancement for the whole group. How do you feel about that?
Right. And that's where that's one of the principal contradictions that I hope to unwork in my larger research projects, which is that there are a bunch of factors that play into that. One is it depends on that individual person's politics, how you might read their own contributions. But I think it's really dangerous to take individual people as representative of larger communities and groups. And so in my own work, I've tried to undo that by making the case that symbolic representation is never enough, and that numeric representation is never enough either.
Okay.
So that what we need is symbolic, numeric, and political practices and structures that involve people other than those groups that seem to be of interest groups.
Mm.
And so what that means is that, for instance, I'll use this example. If we wanted Black studies to appear and have a viable life at the University of Toronto, we would need Black students, Black scholars, and other communities' commitment to something called Black Studies,
yes.
who are not Black.
Right.
And that commitment has to be a commitment that's founded in, you know, what the anthropologist and philosopher Alfonso Lincas used the phrase, what does it mean to care for people with whom you share nothing in common? Hmm. So that sentence is the underlying philosophical approach to the work that I do.
Right. And part of that means not, I don't know, celebrating or romanticizing the individual actions of one person or accomplishments of one person?
Exactly.
That runs counter to so much, at least within the U.S. context, right, where these individuals then become, as you say, symbolic.
Yeah, and it is true that there's less of that in the Canadian context at a certain level, but at other levels they are. So, for instance, in Ontario, you have something called Lincoln Alexander Day. And Lincoln Alexander was a Black conservative politician. And, you know, now that he's passed away and we have that day, he's often revered for all kinds of firsts. But he was also the kind of individual that one would not necessarily mark as being representative of collective Black desires in the province of Ontario. Hmm. So there's a way in which these symbolic figures can be recovered and revered and celebrated for the very thing that they were not actually doing.
Right.
And he's a good example of how that particular kind of practice has become a part of the Canadian landscape as well.
It seems also like a fundamental issue between kind of the one and the many, right? I mean, so is for you and your research, I mean, is progress for the individual progress? I guess it's not necessarily progress for all.
Not at all. I've been writing about Canadian multiculturalism now for about 20 years. My master's work was on Canadian multicultural policy. And even back then, I was arguing that Canadian multicultural policy was about individualizing, that it takes the rhetoric of speaking to groups. So we talk about Black people, we talk about South Asian people, we talk about visible minorities. We take these collective approaches to marking up populations. But it's really about individuality. And I, back then, and I still continue to make the case that a radical multiculturalism is a multiculturalism that is about advancing collectivities and not individuals.
Right, right.
If you look at, for instance, charter challenges in the Canadian context, a group of people can't really bring a charter challenge. A charter challenge comes vis-a-vis an individual. So it's an individual who wants to join the RCMP, and they're saying that you can't wear a turban, who can bring the challenge. And then that opens up for other people to be able, if they're successful, to be able to join the RCMP.
Right.
But it can never be begun as, let's say, all the Sikh communities or Sikh communities are going to bring a challenge.
Interesting.
It always has to be an individual.
Yes, yes. How do politics of recognition play into all this?
Yeah, I mean, the politics of recognition is a really slippery eel in all of this. Because, you know, these symbolic figures who are often recognized as having achieved some notion of success within the normative are often offered up to the rest of us as figures that we should emulate. So recognition of an individual is offered up as recognition also of entire communities. And that's the way in which, for instance, you know, a conservative figure like Lincoln Alexander has been recouped. But for instance, you know, at a level like, let's say right now, the Minister of Immigration, Ahmed Hussein, who's a Somali Canadian, he too is offered up in that similar fashion as a symbolic, no, as more than a symbol, as the actual representation of what you two can become. But we know that most people can't become that.
Sure.
There's only one minister of immigration, right?
Yeah.
And we also know that the vast majority of Somalis who actually arrive in Canada end up having working class lives and are not able to vault the kinds of experiences that he was able to vault to arrive at a place where you can become the federal minister of immigration in Canada. So there's a way in which recognition is news to keep people hoping and desiring, but also to keep them in place.
It's so interesting, because even within basic kind of political thought, recognition is foundational for rights, although you're pointing out that it's also a mechanism of, I don't know what you would say, control or management or something.
Well, I mean, one of the things that in some of my earlier work, I've tried to parse this question of recognition through, you know, engaging with and critiquing Kwame Anthony Appiah. Because again, what happens at the level of nation state is that recognition is always individualized.
Yes.
But it's also, interestingly enough, tied to identity or claim to identity at the same time it wants to disavow it. So if you go back to the example that I gave of an individual Sikh person wanting to join the RCMP and wear a turban, you can bring a charter challenge based on that as an individual that might benefit others after.
Yes.
But the only way you can make that charter challenge is, one, as an individual, two, to claim identity as a Sikh, and so on and so forth. And it's true that then that the courts, the legislative nature of the nation state, the courts and legislation, the juridical and the legislation, makes that a possibility. So what recognition often does at the level of the state is actually to reproduce state power. Right? The state becomes the arbiter
of
what citizens can say is important and right and necessary for them. And so, you know, in a whole series of ways, official multiculturalism, charter challenges, all of these, you know, what do we call in the U.S. constitutional challenges, all help to reproduce the state as the arbiter of what life should look like. So the state actually holds all of our rights.
So recognition can become this type of example and reinforce state power, but maybe sometimes it can also become a platform for disruption.
So that's why I call the particular essay The End of Diversity, because I think it's exactly at those moments that we begin to see how inclusion is about the reproduction of the status quo and not about disruption. You know, individuals who are included, who get recognition and try to disrupt, are often sidelined, often deeply unsuccessful, or often neutered into the institution itself.
Right.
That you find that the institution is not as elastic and as you might want it to be, that in fact it contracts.
Yeah.
And then you become as an individual responsible for why you want to disrupt.
Right.
And so that's one of the ways in which the language of diversity, inclusion, and equity keeps institutions going as they are. So we keep saying that if we engage in diversity, if we engage in equity, if we engage in inclusion, then we're going to change the institutions. Mm. And yet the institutions look the same. Over 40 years of Canadian multiculturalism, sure. And the institutions still look the same.
The institutions are incredibly resilient.
Exactly.
I mean, you write about when those examples or those individuals then fail, what kind of work does that do?
Well, it often supports the hegemonic view. So either it supports the idea that those communities who were formerly excluded are not capable, are not able to operate at the levels and in sustained ways that the institutions demand. Or, you know, again, because it is individualized, that particular individual is not capable. Right. Mm. And this is the thing about the ways in which those forms of recognition, inclusion work, that on the one hand, they're deeply individual. On the other hand, the individual comes to be reflective of the larger collective.
Yes.
Right. So this individual failure is the failure of the larger collective. The individual success is not necessarily the success of the larger collective.
That's still an aspiration or an
yes,
aspirant.
Yes, exactly.
Right? But the failure always seems to be collective,
yes.
or representative.
Yes.
Your essay argues that the language of diversity sometimes works to obscure who is being included and who's being excluded from social structures like politics. Can you give an example?
Yeah. So when I wrote that, I was thinking largely about the ways in which both the language of diversity and the language of racialization work very, very particularly right now in Canada, in which, you know, all non-white people are subject to the possibility of diversity action. And all non-white people are referred to as racialized. But what that doesn't do is it doesn't talk about the different ways in which different non-white people are excluded from institutions, national processes, and so on. So, you know, Black and Indigenous people have very different experiences than, let's say, South Asian and Southeast Asian people. And they have different relationships to this part of the Americas. And so diversity and inclusion can cover over those differences. And so an institution can say that it's a rather diverse institution and not have any Black people.
Sure.
Or it can say it's a rather diverse institution not having any Indigenous people.
Sure, sure.
And I was trying to get at that kind of dynamic. Like, what do we mean when we say diversity? And who are, you know, the persons that would populate a particular place, a university, or a gallery that makes it diverse? And can we call it diverse if there are no Black people?
Yeah.
Can we call it diverse if there are no Indigenous people? And what are the histories of antagonisms that exist between people who are not white?
Sure.
So that the dynamic is not always about whiteness and Blackness or whiteness and Indigenousness. But there are difficulties. There are antagonisms between some Black communities and some South Asian communities. There are antagonisms within South Asian communities between Hindus and Muslims. You know, and so what do we mean when we say diversity? Because it can paper over so many things. It can make so many antagonisms disappear.
Right.
And so I was trying to get at those suggest those kinds of dynamics.
And diversity seems to be strategically vague. I don't know what you think, but you're absolutely right. Like, what do we mean by diversity? Not entirely clear.
And that's a great way to put it. It is strategically vague.
Yeah.
Yeah. Before I came to the University of Toronto, I was a professor at York University. And in my last years at York University, I was the affirmative action director.
Okay.
One of the things that became really apparent to me was exactly that vagueness of diversity.
Hmm.
So that at the time, people were still struggling with what people with disabilities,
yes,
that phrase might mean and how it might be enacted. And I remember sitting in a big faculty meeting with people from all across the faculty, from all across the university, and faculty standing up and saying, well, we can't have people with disabilities as a protected category. How would we know if they have a disability unless they're in a chair? Wow. So any cognitive disability or anything of that sort was immediately suspect.
Huh.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's exactly that language of diversity that doesn't specifically mark anything that allows institutions to continue as they are,
yes,
while claiming to do the work.
Yeah, yeah. And this relates to the concept of racism without race. Can you explain that?
Well, I think, you know, we all now know, we've been all well taught that race is a social construction, but yet racism continues to exist. Yet people continue to differentiate and discriminate on the basis of something called race. So someone look at you and they see you as a white guy, read you as a white guy. Someone look at me, read me as a black guy, and might proceed to engage us differently based on that perception. So while we know that race is about, as a biological entity, is fictional, we know that forms of discrimination, forms of disadvantage, premise in that logic still exist. And so that's what we're trying to get at. And of course, I'm kind of borrowing and adapting from Etienne Balibar, Racism Without Races, in which he was trying to get at the ways in which race became transformed into culture so that we would say that people from this particular kind of culture are not suitable to be in France. And we see that in our contemporary moment. So someone might not say that black people are not welcome in certain parts of the city of Toronto, but they might say people in baggy pants, they might say people who wear running shoes,
okay, yeah,
they might say people who wear baseball caps pulled to the side. So these things become pseudonyms for race, but the practice that accompanies it is a practice of racism.
You also argue that most of the conversations about race function to actually appease white fears. So how can we have a productive conversation about race and racism if, as you say, quote, kind of race is a non-starter?
Mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons that we can and cannot is, one is that, you know, the activists and thinkers who are most willing to push the conversations the furthest are often the ones the furthest removed from engaging with people who hold power in the important institutions. And then people like myself, who are closer to the institutions, the fact that we can be in these institutions means that we've made a bunch of compromises and many, many forms of adaptation. So we use language like diversity, like inclusion,
sure,
like equity as a way to bring white people along. We come up with terms and phrases that are not as alienating, that are not as difficult to bring white people along. Because we also fundamentally believe that people do change and can change.
Right.
And that when people do change and can change, that institutions change. So there's that part of it. But the other part of it means then that we use a language that often does not get at the difficult heart of the matter. And so it preempts much deeper, much far-reaching change. And so, you know, as much as it might have taken, let's say, you know, in the Canadian context, after multiculturalism was announced in 1971, it took another maybe decade and a half to move to the language of anti-racism. And then, you know, another decade to move to the language of equity, and then another decade to move to the language of social justice. And, you know, all of those languages are meant to bring along the institutions in ways that the institutions don't feel so threatened that they're going to fall apart by including others. But those are all languages of compromise. They're all languages that are meant to not irritate, if you will, the system too much.
Sure.
And part of that has to do with the fact that, you know, Black and Indigenous and many people of color know that one of the functions of racism is deep forms of violence, not just economic violence, but, you know, actual physical violence.
Right.
So there's a part of our activism that's also, if you will, shrouded in fear, fear that violence could break out at any time. And we know this from the U.S. context,
sure,
but we know this from other forms of antagonisms around the world, that violence is always, you know, a possible response to the demand for change.
And with this kind of this historical and contemporary fear of violence, how are groups able to become successful or could become successful in transforming institutions?
Well, I think one of the ways that they become successful is that on the one hand, you've got, you know, the possibility of a certain kind of violence. On the other hand, there's another possibility, the cleansing violence of resistance that Frantz Fanon wrote about in Black Skin, White Mask. And so, you know, it's easier to adapt to the language of equity and include some people than to have the forces of the cleansing violence of decolonization sure. come your way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so there's, you know, institutions that want to live are really adaptable to incorporating into them moments or actions that will prolong their life.
Mm. Your essay ends on a very positive note, at least that's how it appears to mm-hmm. me. And you write that, quote, did you hold on to the promise of a decolonial future? How do you envision this future?
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, for me, the hopefulness is in the fact that, one, I believe that everything that we do and practice right now is taught and therefore can be untaught. Hmm. And then I follow this other thinker, Sylvia Winter, who has taught us very much that, you know, the last 500 years of human life has been invented, and it was invented after what she calls, you know, the superstitious religio epoch of Europe. And now we're in the moment of a secularization. And so she's taught me that we can reinvent the world anew. So what that means then for me is that I remain hopeful. I remain committed to the idea that the kinds of ways that we've been taught to imagine difference among us can be retaught. And that, you know, what we now see as the problem of difference does not always have to be the problem. Mm. But that then requires, when I think about this notion of reinvention, I mean, that really involves reinventing how we live together, how we understand what it means to manage our lives collectively and individually. And so that means everything from economy to culture to religion and so on.
And as your role as a professor, how do you see yourself contributing to that?
I teach from exactly this place. So all of my teaching is grounded in this kind of philosophical belief that the coloniality of time and being can be reinvented. And that part of my pedagogy is to engage my students and my students to engage me in what that reinvention might look like. So I see my classroom as a tiny little space of experimentation where we engage in the project of questioning and reinvention.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Professor Kevin Lewis O'Neill in conversation with Professor Rinaldo Walcott from the University of Toronto. On our next episode, we'll talk to Professor Tanya Lee about how getting a proper job no longer means what it used to. Please subscribe on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite app so you won't miss it. This monthly podcast was brought to you by the Center for Diaspora and Transnational Studies at the University of Toronto. I am Yana Romero. Thank you for listening and joining the conversation.